The Theosophical Society in America presents Rohit Mehta, Theosophy of the Invisible and the Intangible.
Friends, we are going to discuss today a subject which is very much relevant to the main theme of the Theosophical Convention and the Summer School, namely planning for the future of the Theosophical Society. It is almost a truism to say that we are in the midst of a crisis, that we are passing through a crisis. This word crisis has been used so much and so long that I believe its impact is completely lost on us. Nevertheless, we must realize that we are today at a major turning point in history. It is not an ordinary turning point, a major turning point. It is a crisis which is not only global, but a crisis that pervades every walk of life, every department of life. There is this turning point so far as history is concerned. What is the nature of this turning point? We can go to one of our brilliant scientists of today, Capra. And Capra, in his book The Turning Point, says that we are passing through a crisis, and he says that this crisis is the crisis of perception. It is a crisis of perception. Crisis is an experience which comes in the life of individuals, in the life of societies also. But there are two aspects of this crisis. Either the crisis leads to what is known in the scientific language as thermodynamic equilibrium. The word thermodynamic equilibrium is a scientific term to describe death, that either the crisis and the dissipation of energy, the working of entropy, leads to destruction and death, or this crisis may emerge into a completely new order, whether for the individual or for the society. One of our brilliant scientists today, the Belgian scientist Prigozhin, has written a book, a fascinating book, called Order Out of Chaos. This is what I'm trying to point out, that either crisis can emerge into destruction and death, or crisis can emerge into a new order of things coming into existence. But it all depends. Prigozhin says that if there is an open and a living system, then the open and the living system creates new order out of chaos. If it is a closed and a mechanistic system, then it goes rapidly towards death and destruction. This is the same idea that was given expression to by Madame Blavatsky in her Key to Theosophy. Madame Blavatsky says in the Key to Theosophy, towards the end portion of that book, she says that the efforts like the Theosophical Society in the past have failed due to various reasons she describes. And she says, the present movement of the Theosophical Society also may fail if its members lose touch with living truths. These are her words. That if the members of the Theosophical Society lose touch with living truth, then like other Theosophical movements in the past, this Theosophical movement may also destroy itself. It is this which we need to consider. If the Theosophical Society has a future, and I believe it has a great future, That future can be assured only if we build up in the Theosophical Society not a closed or a mechanistic system, but an open and a living system. It is this which I would like to discuss, because it is this which has a great relevance to the subject which I have chosen. What is meant by living truth? Madame Blavatsky says that there must be the touch with the living truth. What is the other truth? The other truth is the conceptual truth. Are we in touch with a conceptual truth, or are we in touch with living truth? It is this which will determine what the future of the Theosophical Society is. By and large, we are attracted towards conceptual things, and we seem to believe that because we have the understanding of a conceptual truth, we know that truth in reality. But this is not the case. If you turn to the great Buddhist scripture Dhammapada, in Dhammapada, Lord Buddha, while addressing the pupils, says, "O disciples, cut down the forest, but do not cut down a tree. Cut down the forest, but do not cut down a tree." The statement seems meaningless. If we cut down the forest, then we are likely to cut down many trees. But he says, don't cut down a tree, but at the same time cut down the forest. What does it mean? Forest has no existence. Forest is a concept. It is the tree that has existence. Forest is only a concept. And therefore the Lord Buddha says, cut down the concepts. Cut down the forest of concepts. If you do it, then you will be able to come to the understanding of what reality is. Madame Blavatsky says that you and I, who have been members of the Theosophical Society for a shorter time or a longer time, whatever the case may be, you and I, the members of the Theosophical Society, have to take care that we are not just carried away by conceptual truth, but we are moving towards living truth. My subject this evening is Theosophy of the Invisible and Theosophy of the Intangible. But before we go into the question, we must ask ourselves a question. What is Theosophy? What do we mean by Theosophy? Is Theosophy a collection of concepts? Or is Theosophy something else? What is this Theosophy? It is this that we need to examine. We know that in the vast and the profound Theosophical literature, Theosophy has never been defined. Not only has it not been defined, we have been told that Theosophy is something which cannot be defined, but not only that, it is something which is indefinable. Theosophy is indefinable. And yet, Madame Blavatsky, in one of her books, has given a descriptive definition of Theosophy, a beautiful definition of Theosophy. In her Voice of the Silence, she says, "The right perception of existing things, the knowledge of the non-existent." The knowledge of the non-existent. Not the knowledge of the existent, but the knowledge of the non-existent, the knowledge of the unborn and the unmanifest. It is about this that Madame Blavatsky speaks, that it is this which may be described as a theosophy. Theosophy in its fundamental aspect is unborn and unmanifest. But then is there any relationship between the unmanifest and the manifest? Is there any relationship between the unborn and that which is born? We want to go into it, but we must bear in mind that the essential nature of Theosophy is something that is non-existent, something that is unborn. Now, that which is non-existent is the whole. The existent is broken up, it is fragmented. That which is expressed, By the very virtue of expression, it becomes fragmented, and therefore it is the unborn, the unmanifest. Or, in terms of the modern scientist David Bohm, it is the implicate order, not the explicate order, but the implicate order is the whole. The explicate order is something that is fragmented. And therefore, if theosophy is described as non-existent, then theosophy is the whole. Theosophy in its fundamental nature is the whole. When it is expressed, then it becomes fragmented. And the whole, what is the nature of the whole? The whole is not identical with the total. The total is the sum of the parts. But as Capra himself says in his book, that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. The whole and the total are not identical. What is the nature of this whole? And is it possible for us to come into contact with this whole? We want to examine this, because it is the perception of the whole which may be described as theosophy. One of the scientists of today has very beautifully described what the position of modern science is. He says in one of his writings that our increasing knowledge of details has brought us to the increasing ignorance of the whole. The increasing knowledge of details has brought us to the increasing ignorance of the whole. The scientist is Mr. John Wheeler. John Wheeler, who has given us the idea that we must give up the idea that we are objective observers of the phenomenon of life. He says there is no observer. The observer has to be changed into a participator. Because modern science, and particularly modern physics, tells us that in every act of observation, the observer is involved. And since the observer is involved, what we see is not what is, but what we see is already modified because of the interruption of the observer. In any case, John Wheeler says that the increasing details have brought us to an increasing ignorance of the whole. If this statement is to be understood, then obviously it means that the whole is not the collection of details. We may have detailed examination and investigation of many things. We may collect thousands and millions of details. But just because we have collected large number of details, it does not mean that we have come to the perception of the whole. It is this fact that needs to be understood. Because if theosophy is the perception of the whole, and if our perception as it is, as evidenced by scientists, is a perception that is fragmented, that is not the perception of reality itself, but something that is modified by the intervention of the observer himself, then we have to go into this question of perception. In one of the Upanishads, one of the major Upanishads, rather two of the Upanishads, and one of these Upanishads is mentioned by Madame Blavatsky in A Secret Doctrine. As you know, Madame Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine rests, the whole structure rests on three principles, three propositions. One is the principle of unity, the other is the principle of periodicity, and the third is the principle of intangibility. Because she says, this absolute, about which nothing can be spoken, is something that is unthinkable and unspeakable. This is what Madame Blavatsky speaks about with regard to the third proposition, those three propositions on which the entire edifice of secret doctrine rests. If it is unspeakable, it is unthinkable, then how are we to know it? If it is the unknown, Is it also the unknowable? I wish to point out, and I shall try to explore this particular statement, that reality fundamentally is unknown, but it is not unknowable. And we want to find out, if it is unknown, how can we say it is unknowable? By what means, by what instruments, by what processes, that which is unknown becomes knowable? We will go into it, but I was referring to one of the Upanishads, the Upanishad about which Madame Blavatsky makes mention in that third proposition. She makes mention of the Mandukya Upanishad. There are two Upanishads, two major Upanishads, Mundaka Upanishad and Mandukya Upanishad. They contain the sublime philosophy of Hinduism, sublime philosophy of ancient wisdom. In that Upanishad, there is a dialogue between the teacher and the pupil. The pupil wants to know what is knowledge. And the teacher says, I will tell you what knowledge is. And he says, whatever is gathered from outside, by listening to a teacher, by reading books, scriptural books, whatever is gathered from outside is knowledge. The term that is used in the Upanishad is, it is the lower knowledge. All that is gathered from outside. And this Upanishad says, even if you have read Vedas, if you have read all the scriptures, even then what you have gathered is a lower knowledge. It is only knowledge. Then the pupil says to the teacher, Sir, if all this is knowledge, then where am I to find wisdom? Where am I to find the higher knowledge, not the lower knowledge, but the higher knowledge? Where am I going to find? How shall I come in touch with wisdom? And there you find the beautiful answer that is given by the teacher. The teacher says, wisdom cannot be gathered from outside. But I can give you four characteristics of wisdom. If you come across those four characteristics, then take it that you are in touch of wisdom, that you have transcended the lower knowledge about which I have spoken. And the four characteristics given by the teacher are that first of all, wisdom is timeless. It does not belong to time. It cannot be acquired in the process of time. It is not the property of time at all. It is timeless. The second characteristic that is given by the teacher to the pupil is that it is beyond thought. It is unthinkable, as Madame Blavatsky says. It is timeless. It is unthinkable. It is immeasurable. By no sophisticated measurement even, you can measure this. This is something which transcends all processes of measurement. It is immeasurable. Timeless, unthinkable, immeasurable. And the fourth characteristic that is given in that Upanishad by the teacher to the pupil is that it is intangible. You cannot hold it. You cannot hold it in the palm of the hand. The mind cannot hold it. It cannot be held at all. It is something intangible. Cannot be held and yet can be experienced. This is what this Upanishad says. These four characteristics by which we can understand the nature of wisdom, beyond time, beyond thought, beyond measurement, and beyond all processes of tangibility. I'm sure you have read those propositions which are given in the Idyll of the White Lotus. In the Idyll of the White Lotus, there is once again the third statement about which it is said by the Master that it is something which cannot be heard, which cannot be held, which cannot be spoken about, and yet it can be perceived by he who desires perception. It can be perceived by him who desires perception. We want to go into it. What is meant by one who desires perception? And if there is one who desires perception, will he be able to come to the perception of this that is measureless, that is intangible, that is something beyond time, that is something beyond thought. Is it possible? If it is, we would like to explore this possibility. In any case, theosophy is the right perception of things. In terms of Madame Blavatsky's definition, the right perception of existing things. And in the very right perception of existing things, one comes to the knowledge of the non-existent. The non-existent, as I said, is the whole. Theosophy is the perception of the whole, not the perception of the total. It is the perception of the whole. And if you go to the objects of the Theosophical Society, the second object of the Theosophical Society asks us to study science, religion, philosophy, to have an understanding of the fundamental teachings of science, religion, and philosophy. But even after all this is done, even after we have studied sciences and philosophies and religions, there is still something which is unexplained. And it is to that that the third object of the Theosophical Society refers. Investigating the unexplained. Has not science explained everything? Has not philosophy explained everything? Has not religion explained everything? Obviously, even after the study of all these, there is something which remains unexplained. One of the very eminent philosophers of India of modern times, Sri Aurobindo, in his monumental epic Savitri, says at one place, and these are his words, when all is explained, nothing is known. When all is explained, nothing is known. Because life is not a question of explanation. Life is not a problem to be solved. Life is a mystery to be unraveled. And because it is a mystery to be unraveled, the more and more you unravel the mystery, the more and more you begin to understand what you had not understood before. And yet in spite of the unraveling of the mystery that one may have experienced, there is still something more. As Madame Blavatsky says, veil after veil shall be lifted, but there will be veil after veil behind. Veil after veil behind. In other words, there is so much that cannot form part of explanation. Nothing, no science, no philosophy, no religion can explain it. There is something which remains absolutely unexplained. If all is explained and still nothing is known, surely there is something of a gap so far as explanation and knowledge are concerned. And it is that gap which needs to be understood, because it is there that perhaps we will be able to find the secret of the mystery of life itself. In any case, life is a mystery. Modern physics is beginning to come to that. Modern physics says that we have tried as much as we could, but we have not been able to know what matter is. If matter is the ultimate substance of the universe, and scientists say matter is not the ultimate substance of the universe. They say it is consciousness which is the ultimate stuff of the physical universe. It is consciousness that is all pervading. In fact, as one reads these books of modern physicists, one is reminded of the statement of the Upanishads. In one of the Upanishads it is said, Chittameva hi samsaraha. This is the Sanskrit statement that you find in one of the Upanishads, which says this world is nothing but consciousness. Whatever we see, whatever we hear, whatever we cognize is nothing but the manifestation of consciousness. Consciousness is the basic stuff of this universe. And therefore, in scientific books today you find a great effort to understand what this consciousness is. If I may say so, theosophy is the great science of consciousness in the sense that theosophy places before us various grades of perceptions. Consciousness, to be conscious of something, is to be aware of that thing. Consciousness is, one might say, identical with awareness. We will not go into the deeper psychological and philosophical aspects of consciousness. But consciousness, simply explained, means awareness. But awareness has many grades. Consciousness is not just at one level. In fact, Mrs. Besant, in her Study of Consciousness, a remarkable book which she gave in the early part of this century, and that study in consciousness, Mrs. Besant discusses the question of consciousness. And she says, what is consciousness? And immediately she says, consciousness is the meeting place of the subject and the object, of the perceiver and the perceived. The meeting place where the perceiver and the perceived meet, that is consciousness. And since this is the relationship of the subject and the object which constitutes consciousness, one may say that consciousness is not something that is static. Consciousness is all the time moving. It is not stationary. It moves in the same individual. In the same individual, it moves from time to time. And therefore, it is an extremely mobile state that consciousness is. And in theosophy, we find these various grades of perception placed before us. The elementary, the most primary grade of perception, with which you and I are familiar, is what we may call the sensorial perception. Perception through senses. That is our first door so far as the outer external life is concerned. We know the outer world through the windows of the senses, the five senses. It is the five senses that bring us knowledge, information with regard to the external world. But we all of us know that even though these senses are very efficient, unless they become impaired, these senses, even when they are efficient, they are not able to give us the complete picture of the external world. The senses themselves are limited. We had in India a brilliant scientist who won Nobel Prize. That scientist was Sir C.V. Raman. He specialized in light and color. And he says in one of his lectures that between two shades of the spectrum, just two shades, not the whole spectrum, between two shades of the spectrum, he says there are no less than 250 different colors. Where are they? We don't know. Our eyes can respond only to certain colors. The camera may be able to respond to some more colors. But nevertheless, we have not been able to see 250 colors, which are just in between, say, violet and blue, violet and indigo. Between violet and indigo, there are 250 different shades of colors. The same is the case with regard to sound. We can listen to certain octaves, but beyond that octave and below that octave, we are not able to understand. When the birds fly and they create a very shrill noise, we do not hear it. Because our ear is able to respond to certain octaves of sound, not all the octaves of the sound. There is the smell. One scientist says that our nose is the most uneducated sense. Because in our schools and colleges, we have teachers who teach drawing, we have teachers who teach music, but I do not think there is any teacher in any school or college who teaches how to educate the sense of smell. And yet this scientist says that smells have as many gradations as the color, as the sound. But we are not able to smell all those shades of fragrances that are in the universe. In any case, our first door of perception is the sensorial door. That is how we go. That is our knowledge of the external world. But since senses are limited, even when they have been educated right up to the end point, since the senses are limited, science comes in. And the function of the science is to extend the range and the scope of the senses. And therefore, while the first perception is sensorial perception, the second perception is the scientific perception, the perception through scientific instruments. And we have today many sophisticated instruments. We can see many, many things which we are not able to see with our naked eye. We are able to hear many things which our ear cannot hear. Because of the extension which has been brought about by science, science is engaged in extending the field of senses. Science is engaged in breaking down the limitations of the senses. And so we might say that our second door of perception is the scientific door of perception. But that is not all. There is the third door of perception, and that is the door of psychism, the door of lower psychism, the level of negative psychism. This negative psychism is represented by mediumship, by channeling, about which you read very much in this country, about channeling. What we used to call the medium, now we call the channeling. But this is a negative psychism. Psychism in the sense that one can perceive, one can receive something which is not seen by the eyes, which is not contacted by the scientific instruments, but still something which can be contacted. And there are any number of cases of this lower psychism. I'm purposely using the word lower psychism because that is what is called the negative psychism. It is something where a person receives. There is no conscious transmission at the level of the psychic being, but only the reception, passivity, the receptivity, which is called lower psychism. In fact, if you turn to Madame Blavatsky's Voice of the Silence, in the very beginning Madame Blavatsky says that we are giving these teachings to those who are ignorant of the lower iddhis. That is the term that is used. Iddhi is a siddhi. Siddhi is a psychic faculty. Those who are ignorant of the functions of the lower psychism, those who are carried away by psychism, it is for them that she said we are giving this book the Voice of the Silence. Today, by and large, in the whole world, in the East as well as in the West, but more particularly in the West, we find that psychism is identified with spirituality. A person who has some psychic powers of a negative nature, we regard that psychic power as a power identical with spirituality. But psychism and spirituality are not identical. Nevertheless, I am just now referring to the lower psychism, which is the third door of perception available to certain people. In the 11th discourse of the Bhagavad Gita, there is the Lord showing His universal form. Because Arjuna, the disciple, said, I would like to see your universal form. And Shri Krishna, willing to oblige the disciple, said, all right, I will show you my universal form. But he said, you cannot see my universal form with these eyes. He says the Sanskrit term that is used is divyam dadami te chakshu. I will give you some other perceptive instrument without which you will not be able to see my universal form. In other words, in this particular 11th discourse, the Bhagavad Gita deals with the problem of psychism, not the lower psychism, but the higher psychism, and the higher psychism is known by the term occultism. Occultism is higher psychism. It is not just passivity, it is not receptivity, it is not a mediumship, it is not a channeling process. There is a conscious process. Clairvoyance, clairaudience, precognition, retrocognition, and all the various things we read about in modern books of extrasensory perception. This is occultism. And theosophy has given tremendous contribution to the field of contribution in the course of last 100 and more years. In fact, Theosophical Society has been the one organization, primary organization, that opened the eyes of the people to occult perception. And therefore we see, I'm just very briefly enunciating, there is the sensorial door of perception, there is the scientific door of perception, there is the psychic door of perception, and there is the occult door of perception. And as Bishop Leadbeater describes occultism in his Inner Life, the first volume of the Inner Life, he says, occultism is the science of the invisible. Occultism is the science of the invisible. And in this field of the science of the invisible, Theosophy and the Theosophical Society have done tremendous amount of work. In fact, it has enabled us to open our eyes to something that we had not known so far, something which is beyond the senses, something which is beyond the scientific instruments, something that is beyond the lower psychism. To this, the Theosophical Society, through its vast literature, has brought our attention to four. If this is so, is there any other door of perception than the four doors of perception that I have spoken about? The four doors of perception have one factor which is common. There is one factor which is common to the sensorial, the scientific, the psychic, and the occult perceptions. What is that factor which is common? The factor that is common is the factor of duality. Duality is the factor which is common to all these four grades of perception. It is duality, it is the observer and the observed. It is the perceiver and the perceived. It is the experiencer and the experienced. It is the investigator and that which is investigated. There is a duality. Obviously, there is a duality at the sensorial level. There is duality at the scientific level. There is the duality at the psychic level, because I am the recipient of something which comes from somewhere. There is a duality. But in occultism too, there is the factor of duality. The duality, once again, of the perceiver and the perceived. That there is the wider range of perception, no doubt. The occultist has a wider range of perception. But who interprets the perception in this wider range? The interpreter of that experience is the same that was common in psychism, that was common in scientific perception, that was common in sensorial perception, and that entity is the human mind. The human mind is the interpreter. And so long as the human mind is the interpreter, there is a duality of the perceiver and the perceived, the duality of the observer and the observed, and that duality persists in occult perception too. One of the great saints of modern India, Ramana Maharshi, some of you may have heard his name, may have read his books. Somebody went to Ramana Maharshi and said, "Sir, there is so and so who sitting here in Madras is able to see what is going on in Tibet. There is a person who sitting here in Madras is able to hear what is being talked about in Tibet." And Ramana Maharshi said, "What is great in this? This is what television does. This is what the radio does. What is great in it?" And then he said, "What matters is not what you see at near or you see at distance. What matters is who interprets. You may have knowledge of something that is taking place in a distant country, but after all, the information that is brought by that clairvoyance or clairaudience or whatever faculty may be, in the ultimate analysis, the interpreter is the human mind. And therefore, there is the interpreter, and that which is interpreted, that duality persists so far as occultism is concerned. And so long as there is a duality, there cannot be the right perception of reality itself. So long as there is a duality." Today, modern physics tells us, and you can go to number of books, either take up the book, the physics as metaphor, or take up the book, mechanistic and non-mechanistic science, or any of these books you take up, and you will find the physicist telling us that we have gone no further than those men of Plato about which Plato wrote in his books. The cavemen of Plato, they looked at the wall, and on the wall the shadows were cast, because the light was behind, and what was happening behind, the shadows of that thing was cast on the walls. And these men were looking at the shadows. They were delighted. Somebody said, "Why don't you turn your face and look what is outside?" And they said, "Why? Why should we look? This is something beautiful that we are seeing. We are seeing the shadows." The modern physicist, particularly in that book, Physics as Metaphor, says that we physicists have not moved an inch further from the cavemen of Plato. We are still there. We are only dealing with shadows. He says our shadows have changed, but still we are dealing with shadows. We do not know what reality is. We do not know what the real nature of things is. In fact, Einstein long ago spoke about it. Einstein said that no scientist knows what electricity is. He said the scientist only knows how electricity behaves. We do not know what electricity is. We know only how matter behaves. That is all that science is able to tell us. And therefore, there is no direct perception of reality. What Madame Blavatsky called the unveiled perception. There is no unveiled perception of reality. There is only the appearance, and the appearance is regarded as reality. The change between the 19th century science and the 20th century science is this. Although both these sciences are still dealing with shadows, the 20th century scientist knows that he does not know reality. He is only seeing the appearance, that which appears from his own scale of observation. The 19th century scientist thought that appearance itself was reality. This is all the difference that has taken place for so far as scientific progress is concerned in the course of last 100 years. That today's scientist says that we know only from our scale of observation. One Swiss scientist very beautifully says, he says it is the scale of observation which creates the phenomenon. If I say a particular phenomenon is taking place, how do I know? I know it because it is seen from my scale of observation. Change your scale of observation and take another scale of observation. You will see something else. In the Hindu philosophy, again and again one illustration has been given. The Indian philosophers gave that illustration of the rope being mistaken for the snake. What is lying is the rope. But I see the snake. From where has the snake come? The snake doesn't exist. What exists is the rope. From where has the non-existent snake come? This is the subject that is discussed in philosophical treatises, particularly of the Hindus. In other words, it is just the appearance. When appearance is regarded as reality, then we are caught in Maya, what is called illusion. Illusion doesn't mean that nothing exists. Illusion means that that which appears is regarded by me as real. When appearance is regarded as the real, surely we have not the right perception. We have a perception which cannot be described as the correct perception. It is perception which is very, very faulty and very, very defective. Wherever there is a duality, the duality of the observer and the observed, there this factor will remain, that we will not be able to see the whole, we will only be able to see the part. And we may go on collecting part after part and say that I have known the whole, I have not known the whole. For example, in theosophical teachings, we very often speak of the principle of correspondences. And one of the principle of correspondence which we are familiar with, by and large, we are familiar with is as above, so below. That is the correspondence, as above, so below. But we do not know what the above is. And therefore we have changed that statement to mean that as below, so above. As below, so above, because we do not know what the above is. In fact, you find that in the Christian scriptures, where it is said that God created man in His image. But man thought he was wiser. He created God in His image. And therefore we are creating reality in our image, because we do not know what the above is. We are only familiar with the below, and we think that the extension of the below will give us the understanding of the above. And therefore these correspondences, they need to be examined afresh. Or we speak about death. And while speaking about death, we say, oh, we know life after death. But life after death is not the meaning of death. Life after death is continuity. It is not a matter of discontinuity. Death is a moment of discontinuity. By talking about life after death, we are only talking of a modified continuity. We do not call it death. We cannot call it death, because death is a moment of discontinuity. Or take up the sevenfold constitution of man. And we say, yes, we know the man. We don't know the man. The sevenfold constitution of man is the house in which man lives. It is a house of great many floors. It's a mansion. It is not just a small house, the physical house. But there are many, many mansions. And man lives in those mansions. That is all that we speak about when we talk of the constitution of man. The question still remains, where is man? Constitution is not man. Where is man? This is one of the questions which remains unexplained. Just as death is the question which remains unexplained. Just as the above and the above remains unexplained. Or talk of evolution. In evolution, there is one factor which we have missed in our discussions, in our explanations, and that is the factor of mutation. How does mutation take place? The evolutionary scientists in the beginning did not recognize this factor of mutation. But they had to recognize. And even a scientist of the caliber of Julian Huxley says, we do not know how mutations happen. We can study a mutant organism, but we do not know how mutation happens. Mutation is one of the unexplained so far as the sphere of evolution is concerned. One can go on examining many things. And therefore we have to admit that there are many, many things which are still unexplained. In fact, no philosophy, no science, no religion can give a complete explanation. In fact, we have to agree with Sri Aurobindo that when all is explained, nothing is known, because life is a great mystery. To me it seems that at this major turning point in history, and that major turning point in history has its impact on a movement like the Theosophical Society, because nothing exists in isolation. As Professor Eddington used to say, that electron vibrates and the whole universe shakes. There is an interrelationship. The Theosophical Society is not an isolation. Theosophy is not something of an isolated philosophy. You and I are not isolated. We are very much a part of the society, very much of a part of the world phenomenon. And therefore, if there is a major crisis that has overtaken the other fields of life, that major crisis is affecting our theosophical understanding as well. And to me it seems that during this major turning point, we must revise and reassess our own understanding of theosophy. We will have to challenge many, many of our assumptions. We have accepted many things, and we seem to be thinking that we have the complete understanding. If we have complete understanding, why don't you erase the third object of the Theosophical Society? Is there anything unexplained? If there is nothing explained, there is no meaning in having the third object of the Theosophical Society. But evidently the leaders of the Theosophical Society, the founders and the later leaders, saw that there was a factor, even after understanding science, religion and philosophy, there is something which remains unexplained. I tell my theosophical audiences all over the world that you must rearrange your study classes. And I tell them your study classes must be, what is it that is explained? But what is it that is not explained? We must become aware of that which is unexplained. And the unexplained is in the area of evolution, in the area of death, in the area of karma, everything which we have taken as the theosophical principles. There is much that remains to be explained. And I think in the New Age, if we are talking of the program of the Theosophical Society in the future, then our study classes, our conferences, our lectures must more and more turn to that which is unexplained. How are we going to understand that which is unexplained? Are we aware of it? And to me it seems the moment we become aware of the unexplained, there will be a fresh energy that will come into the Theosophical system. Because then we will become an open system, not a closed system. When I inquire, yes, I know many, many things. Theosophy has explained many, many things. But there are many, many things that still remain unexplained. If in our lodges, in our branches, in our centers, in our sections, if more and more members begin to realize, then you will see that a new energy, because inquiry itself initiates energy. With inquiry, new energy comes. And we shall be able to see this new energy motivating our activities, both individual as collective. In any case, these are the things and many other things which still remain unexplained. If they are unexplained, is there a possibility for us to find an explanation? Is there a way by which we can move into this direction? If the mind cannot, as we have seen, that the mind can never give us an understanding of the whole. The mind always fragments everything. The mind is caught in the process of time. And time fragments everything. And therefore, through the mind and through its instrument of time, it is not possible for us to come to the understanding of the whole. And without the understanding of the whole, the things which have remained unexplained will remain unexplained. We will not be able to find explanation. Our theosophical philosophy then will not be a holistic philosophy. It will be a partial philosophy, dealing with parts, dealing with fragments, but not a philosophy which gives us an understanding of the whole. I suggest, and I have no time to develop that particular theme, but I suggest that it is possible. If mind cannot give us an explanation, the mind's explanation we have in our books, vast literature of theosophy, we have the explanation of the mind. The explanation of the mind can be transmitted from one mind to the other. But there is a layer of explanation which cannot be transmitted, but which can be experienced. It cannot be experienced by the processes of the mind, however erudition we may be able to bring, however scholarship we may be able to bring, but it is not possible for us to understand something which is beyond the scope of the mind. Then where are we to understand? Where is theosophy? What is theosophy? Where shall we be able to have the perception of theosophy? The right perception of existing things, the knowledge of the non-existent. Where shall we be able to come to it? Not in the time process, but it is only in the interval of time. One of your great anthropologists, Castaneda, has written several books. And Castaneda has related in his book the instructions that he received from his master. Whether he did or did not, we do not want to go into it. But in one of his books, the master told him that it is twilight which is the door to the unknown. That twilight is the door to the unknown. Twilight not in the physical sense. We know what twilight is, neither day nor night. Neither night nor day. It is something that intervenes. It is something which is neither this nor that. And since the mind can know only this or that is the dialectical process with which mind is familiar. This is the Cartesian approach of the mind, that it says this or that, but neither this nor that. It is this which is twilight. And it is said that it is twilight which is the door to the unknown. The unknown is knowable, not knowable by the processes of the mind, not by logic, not by mathematics. Bertrand Russell, as you know, a great mathematician, he himself said in one of his books that by mathematics we prove many things, but we do not know what we are proving. We prove many things, but we do not know what we are proving. This is what is said by Bertrand Russell. And so not by process of logic. I am not suggesting that logic has no value, that mathematics has no value. Logic and mathematics, they have relevance in their own fields. But there is something which is timeless, something that is beyond thought, something that is immeasurable, something that is intangible, which cannot come within the purview of logic or of mathematics. And still, the unknown is not unknowable. The unknown is knowable, but not by the processes of the mind. It is only twilight of consciousness. What does it mean? Where all movement of the mind has ceased, for the time being. Because time, the flow of time and the flow of thought are identical. We are aware of time in terms of the flow of thought. When the flow of thought is slow, then the time seems long. When the flow of thought is fast, then time seems short. And therefore the movement of time is not different from the movement of thought. If that is the case, then when thought ceases, when for the time being the thought has come to an end, then in that cessation of thought, in that silence, and only in that silence, one can experience the intimations of the intangible. The experience of the intangible is there. We have, for more than 100 years, worked under the auspices of the Theosophical Society to give to the people the knowledge of the invisible. We have talked of the theosophy of the invisible. I suggest the time has come when we must be able to venture into this new field and give to the people the theosophy of the intangible. It has been indicated. If you turn to the final statement of Light on the Path, because Light on the Path and the Voice of the Silence, they are the most important of the books of Theosophical Mysticism. But if you turn to the last portion of the Light on the Path, the Light on the Path says therein, hold fast to that which has neither substance nor existence. Impossible. How can we? The mind says this is absurd. Hold fast to that which has no substance. Not only that, hold fast to that which has no existence whatsoever. How can you do it? And yet you will find there these many of the paradoxical statements. The paradoxical statements are there. In Voice of the Silence, in Light on the Path. The Voice of the Silence says, give up life if thou wouldst live. It's a paradoxical statement. A paradoxical statement cannot be solved by the mind. The mind cannot see any meaning in it. The mind is unable to find out anything so far that paradox is concerned. There are any number of paradoxes. If you go to the Bhagavad Gita, if you go to the 15th discourse of the Bhagavad Gita, the very first verse of that discourse talks of a fascinating paradox, one of the greatest of the paradoxes that you find in the Bhagavad Gita. I am not going to recite that verse in Sanskrit, but there are two words which are used. The two words are the ashvatha and the avyaya. Ashvatha means that which is not going to exist till tomorrow. That which has no existence till tomorrow, that is the meaning of ashvatha. And yet it is imperishable. Avyaya means perishable. That which will not last till tomorrow, and yet it is imperishable. This is one of the great paradoxes that you find in the Bhagavad Gita. For a paradox, there is no explanation by the mind. And life is full of paradoxes. Heisenberg, The great scientist said once that when we put a question to nature, nature replies by a paradox. When we persist in our question, then nature replies with a sharper paradox. Nature speaks, life speaks only the language of paradoxes. Whether you want to call it the paradox of the wave and the particle, call it by whatever name you like. Life is a paradox and mind can never understand a paradox. The paradox can be resolved, but it can be resolved only when the mind is quiet, when the mind is silent. The mind is not able to perceive. There is no right perception. In one of the Sufistic books, the books of Sufism, and in Sufism there is a very great teacher, a woman teacher, and one pupil goes to this woman teacher and says, I'm knocking at the door of truth for quite some time, but the door does not open. Why does not the door open? And the teacher said, you may go on knocking at the door of truth for 1,000 years, but the door will not open. And the pupil said, why will it not open? Why will the door not open? And the teacher said, once again said, you may go on knocking at the door of truth for 1,000 years. The door will not open for the simple reason that the door has never been closed. For the simple reason that the door has never been closed. You are knocking at an open door. That is our difficulty of spiritual life. We are knocking at the open door. Because spirituality demands right perception. I must be able to see that the door is open, I can walk through it. But I see the door as not open but closed, and I go on knocking at the door. Who has closed this door? It is the mind with its own projections has closed the door. The door which is open, but I am unable to see the openness of the door. And therefore this requires the complete cessation of the projecting activities of the mind. It is only when the projecting activities of the mind cease, even for a split second it does not matter. Then in that split second and there alone, the right perception will come. Once again to quote Sri Aurobindo, he says, it is the moment that sees, the ages toil to express. The moment sees. The perception comes only in the timeless moment. The perception comes only in the silence of the mind. Then the mind requires ages and ages to express what has been found in that timeless moment. To me it seems that while we have developed the theme of time, now the time has come when we must be able to deal with the timeless moment. Because timeless moment is that timeless moment, that moment where the experience of silence comes. Mind cannot explain many, many things, but the explanation comes in the moment of silence. In that moment of silence, and meditation is nothing but the experience of silence. If I sit in meditation for hours and hours, but do not come even to that momentary experience of silence, then I suggest our meditation has gone wrong. Meditation is the experience of the moment of silence. It is in silence that the unexplained explains itself. It is in silence that there is the unraveling of the great mystery of life itself. And therefore, to me it seems that during the coming years, we must be able to give to the people the philosophy and the psychology of silence, because this is where we must find the fulfillment of the work of the Theosophical Society in the future. We have given to the world theosophy of the occult. The time has come when we must give to the people the theosophy of mysticism. And if we can give that, then mysticism will be able to solve many of the problems of modern physics. Mysticism will be able to solve many of the problems of our psychological living. And mysticism will be able to solve many, many problems so far as our larger life is concerned. Theosophy of the invisible. Yes, we have done it. But the time has come we must embark upon the theosophy of the intangible. We must move more and more into these fields of the silences of the mind, because it is in the silence of the mind that the unexplained explains itself. Thank you very much.